George, we have had a lot of conversations at work.
Yes, sir.
And I have loved them all. And I thought we would get started if you would just tell us kind of where you grew up and how you grew up, and we'll get going.
Well, I guess I won't go too far into me and Cleveland, but I'd like to, you know, start from Oklahoma City in 1975 is when we got here. It was a huge, to me, for that time, it was a huge culture shock. You know, being from the East Coast, you got black dirt. It's always cold. We never had warm days. We had not so cold days, but you got used to it. I think even the little kids had hair on their chest. You know, I wasn't happy because my mom, she had decided to leave my dad because he was abusive. He was an alcoholic. Yeah, you know, once she finally got the courage to leave, man, I still remember like it was yesterday. She just had this look on her face. Every single aspect about that day, I remember with all kind. I mean, clarity, super clarity. It was 3:30, you know, afternoon. We was already home from school. And I was sitting there watching the Little Rascals. Oh, wow. Yeah, and my mom, she had been gone, you know, but we were what they called latchkey kids. We let ourselves in the house. We already knew what we were supposed to do and everything. And she came home, had this look on her face, and said, "Get your stuff and let's go." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "We're leaving." I said, "Okay." You know, we're thinking we were leaving, going. She said we were going over to her cousin's house. And after getting to the cousin's house, it got late. And I'm like, "Well, I guess we're spending the night. Are we excused from school?" Needless to say, that didn't happen. Next thing you know, we were on a Greyhound bus to Oklahoma City and got down here with my mom. Her dad was here. We stayed with him for a while. He was a pastor. Totally not what you would expect. Man, I just hate to make it seem like it was all bad, but you know, after about a month, we realized he was just as abusive as my dad, you know, but more psychological. His every explanation for what he did was like, "It'll make you tough, make you strong, turn you into a man, everything." And so being a little kid, I'm thinking like, okay, some of it is necessary, some of it isn't. But long story short, it wasn't working out. But before I get further into that, I mean, I still remember that first conversation that I was a part of, you know, coming to Oklahoma City. And this was my introduction in 1975, February 14th. So we get off the bus, go into the bus station. Right away, you know, my little kid logic is saying, "We're not home. We're nowhere in Ohio. That's a different place. Red dirt. People look different. It smelled different. You know, the air felt different." And I said, "Well, I guess we ain't home." But, and I don't know how real you want the language to be on this. I mean,
you can say however you want.
Okay. You know, my mom and my dad, you know, aside from their setbacks in the marriage, they did go out of their way to raise us in a way to where we weren't racist or prejudiced. Matter of fact, we didn't even know color existed until we got to Oklahoma. So one of the first conversations I heard, we got off the bus and I'm holding my mom's hand and I'm just looking around. I'm just culture struck, man. Like, what is this? What is this? And
what year were you?
This was 75.
75.
Yes, sir. And the first thing the man, there was this man sitting on the bench with his buddy. And he said, "Nah, it's all we need. Another family of, you know, N-words coming to leech off the system." Me still not knowing what that word meant. I'm a kid now. I was but 9 years old, I think. I was more offended by the tone. You know, I didn't know what the word meant because we was never taught that. But I recognized the tone. It was an angry tone. And I couldn't understand why he was angry with us, you know, because he was giving us the hostile look, you know. And so my mom, she just kind of gathered us up and she said, "Come on, let's go." And I'm looking back and it was this Native American guy sitting in the corner. Man, you could tell he had been there for a while. I mean, he had a little stain around him, you know, to where like, hey, he had an eye missing. One of his eyes is just missing. And then I figured out he was a vet, you know, later on. But he looked at me and said, "Hey, little brother, can you spare some change?" Like, one of my things was, you know, was as a kid, I would collect 50-cent pieces. Everything with John F. Kennedy on them. I had like 20 of them in my pocket. And so when he said that, I didn't have any more money other than that, you know, because I was thinking, my mom said, "We're going to go visit my dad." And I was thinking, I'm going to show him my collection. So this man is sitting over there when he said, "Hey, brother, you know, can you spare something?" And I gave him what I had, you know. And he said, "God bless you, brother." And he said, "Don't let them bother you." That's what he told me. He said, "Don't let them bother you," because he could see I was hurt. Fast forward a little bit. So now, as a teenager, I'm dealing with Oklahoma City. I found out that there was a difference. You know, first thing that we could see was we're poor now. You know, my dad had three jobs. You know, he was probably the hardest working man I ever met in my life. He made sure my mom never lacked for anything. You know, she saw something on TV, you know, he would just get it for her. But now we're in this situation. We had to endure welfare. And I think nowadays it's a little bit more dignified because they had this little card. And, you know, you walk up there, you swipe, and before anybody realizes what you got in your hand, you're out of there. But we had the old coupon book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, with the purple dollar and the orange dollar and the green. And I was like, "What is this?" You know, I had no idea what it was, you know, but I just knew whenever we went to the store, my mom said, "Well, take this." And I said, "Well, Mom, we need some money. You know, they won't let us. This is Monopoly money." And I'm laughing, joking. And now she said, "No, just take this." It was just different. It was just different because people kind of treated you like, I don't know. I wasn't used to it. You know, I felt like I was less than, you know, for the first time. And that feeling kind of growing up as a black kid, it becomes a constant. And I don't even remember at what point it just became accepted, you know, where I stopped realizing it and it just became the norm to me. You know, people was going to look down at you. If anything happened, if you was there with two or three people, they would immediately look in your direction. Like, "You're the cause of it." So after a while, you just get used to it. Another thing you got used to is seeing that it didn't make a difference if you were behaving or not, or if you even knew the other kids or not. You all got grouped up. I remember going to one of my escapes, you know, because I was still trying to deal with not having my dad around. Just the life was just so different. It was so different, and I didn't like it. So I would escape to the library. I was the kid my dad thought that I was going to grow up to be some kind of wuss, man, because I was always reading. And I would read the encyclopedia. If you knew my dad, he's a country boy, man, from Alabama. He said, "Oh, that ain't going to do." He thought that was going to be some kind of weakling. But I would go to the library. These kids, I'm sure they probably had a similar background as I did. You know, the house was broken or dysfunctional, and they have a tendency to want the attention that they can't get. So they over there getting loud, you know. They could be on the far right side of the library, and I'm on the far left. And when the trouble broke out, they made everybody leave. So, you know, I think that kind of plays into when people see one group of black kids do so, or black people, period, do anything, have a tendency to associate the group, everybody. You know, we're all a part of it, or we have some kind of knowledge of what's going on. You know, you can't be an innocent bystander. And that was sad, you know. It still is. You don't get to be an individual. You don't have a individual voice. When you do speak, people have a tendency to think that you're speaking for the whole. One of my friends on Facebook, we would talk about race relations. And she sent me a post about Morgan Freeman's comment on Black History Month. And he said, "Well, he, you know, we don't need one." I said, "Well, that's his opinion." But I told her I understood why he said that, you know, because it seems to state that we're separate and somehow want to continue the separation. And that's not how it is. Not to me, not in my estimation. I feel like the distinction of Black History Month had to come because the historic contributions that black people would make would just not be included. You didn't read about it. You didn't hear about it in school. History was history for other people. And it always seemed to paint it in a certain perspective. So everybody else was like added in as, well, they did a little something here, did a little something here. Nothing innovative, nothing massively important. So you kind of like, you get this feeling like, I am second class. I don't have a voice. And the fall off is when you get to this point where it's like, why even try? So now you got this mass of people with this troubled soul, you know, pretty much. It's like, I don't have any input. I don't have any say. Kind of like, damned if I do, damned if I don't. So you get so much of this. I think that kind of helped to perpetuate the no snitching, stuff like that. I mean, because when you look up and kids being juveniles, you see them do a little something stupid, you don't expect the kid to be killed. You expect the police to come line him out, you know, say, hey, you can't do that. Where's your mom? Where's your parents? But you would see this all too often. They would just take the kid, cuff him, little kids, put him in the back seat, make the block. That kid come back looking, they worked him over. You see that enough. And something in you says, well, I can't let that happen. So even if you know the kid is full of crap, he's doing something he ain't got no business doing, you may have a tendency to try to protect him, because that shouldn't just be the single paint stroke. Well, they got to go. So I think some of the unspoken, or I don't know what to say, hidden aspects of being black, I guess, people just have a tendency to immediately discredit because of the stigma around it. And I say, well, they're probably lying. We had a situation at work, and one of my coworkers had brought some chips, you know, to work for herself, and she didn't want to finish them. So he said, George, you want these? And I said, sure. And another coworker came to the back, and she immediately, you know, I was like, did you take these? And I said, well, she gave them to me. But it was the expression on her face first, like, I have the authority to ask. I'm like, well, do I come off as a person who would just do that? And then she kind of caught herself, and, you know, and there was a whole bunch of that weird feeling, that void, like, hey, I just trespassed all over this guy's integrity. But I let her off the hook. I started joking about something else and blah, blah, blah. But you see it happens so often in a span of a single day. You can't complain about every single incident. So you get this toughness about you. It doesn't protect you at night when you go to sleep and you start thinking about it, and you start thinking about how powerless you are to affect your own environment. It has to be, I make decisions sometime at work. I'm not college educated, but I make decisions at work that come from experience, you know, from things that I've done in my work history, and they still get second guessed. It's like, well, we need two or three more people to come verify. So, well, that's fine. As long as they consistently come to verify, then I know it's part of the process and not part of you not trusting my judgment. And it just kind of just becomes this thing that you always deal with and you don't always talk about because it happens too regular. Mm-hmm. Just like breathing. Mm-hmm. You don't really think about it, you just do it. And I would honestly say that, you know, for a lot of people, especially at my age, you might have some psychological damage going on up there. You know, you just, where do you put the rage? Because some days you just can't take it. You know, some days you just be pissed off. Anybody is the very next person. But you have an antidote for that. Angry black male. So you always have to be two steps ahead of even yourself. You can't get pissed off. You can't blow up. You can't have a normal human reaction to a lot of things. Talking with some coworkers about, you know, some of our recent events, riots. And I said, you know, it's pretty human to have a reaction when you feel like you are being violated 24/7. It's only so much you can actually just, screw it. And then, you know, you do say something. And if you have the nerve and audacity to pick up a sign, even if you're just standing there peacefully with your protest all written out, that's the extent of your protest is on a card or a poster. And you can't do that without being seen as a thug or a violent, you know, so you just kind of put society in this mode to where they become immune to the things that they see. You know, so what? You could see a guy get shot in the chest, point blank range, in plain view of everybody. And somehow, even if his hands are just completely restrained, like I think we know what we're talking about here, and it's still his fault. Everything is your fault. You didn't do this. You didn't do that. You didn't do this. You didn't comply. You know, you see people get cut down with both hands up in the air, you know, and they still get cut down. And you just become this person that's always cautious. And I don't think that's healthy for a human being. So, yeah, it's some volatile characters out there, man. You probably don't even know. It's like, it is close, you know, it is close from just losing it. And I had a moment today. It was just simply because I just, you know, sometimes I don't feel respected in a role that I've been hired to do. You know, and if that's the case, you know, either let me go or assign me to something else. I'd be more than happy. You know, as long as I get to keep my job, you know, I'm good. But it bothers me, you know, because people do beat the odds. They do beat the odds and they become this person who has this long success story and you totally own it. You just get real happy. You know, that's why a lot of people, even people who didn't particularly care for Barack Obama, when he became president, they were cheering, you know, like, hell yeah. You know, we're heading somewhere, you know, maybe change is coming. Not necessarily being a fan of his policies or what he did, but just the thought that America just may be trying to grow a little bit. But, you know, even in the highest seat in the country, every decision he made, I'm sure had to be second guessed. And, well, I don't know, you know, maybe he's doing this. You got to be so many other things. You can't just be, you know, looking out for everybody. You have to be a certain thing. A lot of people I'm kind of going all over the place. I'm sorry.
No, you're okay.
You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, he's not doing anything for the black people. I said, think about it. I mean, can he do that? As the first black president, can he actually go out on a limb and say, you know, I'm going to take care of the brothers on this one? Right. His presidency would have lasted every bit of what, 2 or 3 weeks? And maybe he'd have been out of there. But, you know, so he had to, like I said, you got to be 2 or 3 steps ahead of even yourself, you know, to kind of see what it looks like down the road. And he's like, no, I can't go that route. I have to be as generic as possible. I have to be really good at being generic, but at the same time being impactful in some kind of way. I can't be half-assed because the narrative behind that, oh, we gave him a chance. And look how they did it. They did it half-assed. Mm-hmm. So you always have to, it's mentally, it's always an Olympics going on, man. He's just nonstop.
You know, I found it interesting too when you mentioned Obama having all the people that you were talking to be really excited about him coming into office. I remember talking to people around that time as well, and you know, some people were really excited, but then of course some people were not, for reasons that is a whole nother podcast. But I found it interesting that people just were not that excited about him being in office, and probably for some it was just because of the sheer fact that he was black. And I'm sure that he felt that. I can't imagine that he wouldn't feel the pressure of that from both sides, but
right, he did. I mean, you know, cause I remember seeing his face, and he probably actually believed that he was going to be allowed to make the changes that he wanted to. I tried to encourage as many people as I could to kind of look at the original documents, the original drafts to the healthcare situation. And if they would have looked at it before it got beat down to the current state that it was in before it got, I don't know if it's completely repealed now or not. It favored all Americans. It was going to be a good thing, but it's only so much compromise you can actually put into a program before it just kind of like falls short of what you intended for it to do. And I think that's exactly what happened. But I think I still believe now that we're heading in the right direction, because this current presidency is so crazy that, I mean, I've seen diehard people who are completely to the way far right. They're starting to, you know, break camp and go a little bit more center, because they see, I think this was needed and necessary, not only to bring light to our political system and how it's working or how it's not, but also exactly where we are as far as, you know, race relations. We continue to be afraid of, I don't know what we're really afraid of. I can only guess that it might be some kind of repercussions, and people don't need to wait for that kind of thing. If that was going to happen, I think it would probably would have happened by now. Me speaking just for myself, I think the best way to heal the country and heal all of these millions of people who always feel like I'm nowhere near the top scale, I'm somewhere at the very bottom. I think the best way to heal these folks or get them in the mode of healing is to just admit it. So yeah, man, it was a bad deal. You guys got screwed. You got screwed royally. It was kind of set up for you to continue to stay screwed. And yeah, we got to look at it. Just that kind of conversation alone, you would hear this gigantic exhale, I'm sure. You won't get people rioting in the street trying to chop off heads and all of this crap. I mean, because I think that's our fear stops us from trying to grow and change. We're fearful of repercussion. It's like nobody wants to recreate the monsters. We'd like to have them good and exercised away from our culture. But I still feel like there's a chance, because you're starting to see people who are just, you know, traditionally just locked into this mindset, and they're starting to reconsider. They say, like, man, this ain't going right. I don't think it's going to stop there. You know, I think the revolution is going to probably be a little bit more quiet than people thought or what they expected. And once it's already underway, let's put it like that. The revolution is already underway. The old guard is falling apart, because it's obvious that this privilege is crippling us. We can't move anywhere. We can't move forward. We can't really go backwards, because, you know, you get ostracized immediately if you try to, you know, herald back to these times that was so great. It's like, dude, you got to get specific. But we're going forward regardless. And I think that in doing that, we'll have a healing, not just as far as racial understanding, but the gender thing is finally, I think the thing about same sex marriages and all that good stuff, I think it's starting to get the recognition that people who are a part of that want it, to where folks are seriously considering. Like, we'll have a little bit of overkill, you know, because it's just like anything when it's brand new, you don't want to use it to the fullest extent. But I see the same thing happening as far as religion. I mean, because you can't really say that you're a quote unquote Christian and support some of the things that some of these people say. As a Christian person in America, how can you sleep at night saying it's okay to completely just run over protesters? Hey, if they're in the street, I'm just going to run them over. You sure? You know, I mean, like, is this the story? Because, I mean, I could show you pictures of people being lynched and little kids out there, and that should not happen.
Right.
You know, if you're going to lynch them, let it be adults. You know, it's a reprehensible thing to do to a person, but do not turn your children into monsters. Because, I mean, it's just no coming back from that.
You know, I find it interesting as well when you talk about the far right that, you know, they're traditionally very pro-life when it comes to abortion, which I am too. I don't want to see any babies get killed
right
by any means. But
absolutely.
On the flip side, they're also very pro-death penalty.
Yes,
so
sir.
It seems kind of funky that if it's a baby, then their life is precious and deserves to be saved. But if the person does something wrong, kill him. Kill him.
Right, right. Or if he looks different from me and, you know, he's did something, I don't care to know what all he did, but you should get rid of him.
Right.
You know, you can't be like that. I mean, it doesn't hold up. I mean, just imagine standing on Judgment Day, if you believe in that kind of thing, standing on Judgment Day trying to explain to the Lord, well, yeah, you know, they had to go. I said, well, who gave you that authority?
Right.
I was just recently, man, and it made me sad. I was looking at some of, I can't think of what the name of the address was, but it was Chief Joseph for the Nez Perce Indians. And he was talking about his last stand and the conditions of the treaty that he was trying to put out there. And they pretty much just mowed over there. Like, yeah, just sign. And I felt, he's long gone, but I felt the desperation in his conversation as I was reading it. He said, I want this to end. I just want to be able to go find the children that I've lost along this trail, whether I just need to bury them at home. And, you know, it's just, I don't even care about this thing now, because what you're fighting for, I just don't believe in. Apparently the Nez Perce didn't believe that you could own land. And so the only ones who can own anything is the ones that create it. If you create this parcel of land, then you could probably sell it. But if it was here pre-existing before you and I, by whose authority are you selling? Mm-hmm. And he could never get an answer. And so he knew then that the people that I'm dealing with, them not necessarily, oh my goodness, my militant family members will probably be, I know they're hearing me right now. I know they can hear me. But I would tell them, and I said, well, these people are historically like this. And I said, it is not locked in skin. So it's a mindset. Mm-hmm. It's a perversion of justice. It's a perversion of righteousness flipped to become self-righteousness. And you just get lost in this zeal to do what you feel like is the thing that you called to do. So you need to eradicate these people from this land. And it makes me think about, and it choked me up. I was thinking, you know, Chief Joseph was saying, by whose authority is this cleansing being ordered? And you ask that enough times, a reasonable person will stop. They'll pause and they say, well, you know, hey, maybe he has something. We'll do it like this. We'll do it like this. But then you have those that they're still caught in the zeal, you know, nope. And I think what we're seeing now is a burning off of those people, and it's fear. It's fear that's driving them. You know, it's like, well, this is the end of our power. And to me, it's all spirit. It's all spirit. I believe it's the enemy with a last ditch effort to keep. Fear is the one thing that the enemy knows that keeps us going. We'll just, oh my God, you know, what's happening? Because if we saw some nukes flying through the air, you know, we'd probably be flipping out. That's why I was, you know, talking to some of my friends who are former military, you know, past and present, some of my coworkers. I said, how can you be so very much behind these military strikes? Because you know full well, you won't hit every single target that you're intended to hit. You're going to get some casualties. You know, that's why they created the word insurgents, you know, to take care of the losses that are not necessarily military. Kind of like screed off the responsibility part. I'm like, you know, it's enemy territory. We don't know who they were. They were insurgents. Mm-hmm. So they were resisting us. So just by that resistance alone, they're enemies. And that reasoning doesn't always play out perfectly when you're the victim. Like I was saying, I said, if we were getting shelled right now, we would immediately want it to stop. If we looked up and we saw our government was defenseless and they couldn't help us, we would want it to stop. We would probably run out there. You know, some people would probably get killed trying to make it stop. And then some people would have a distinctly human response. I think now you're occupied. You have an armed guard standing out in front of your house. You've been living there all your life, free to go and come as you please. And now this guy telling you 7 o'clock, it's all done at 7 o'clock, martial law. It pisses you off. You're an adult. I say, hey, you can't tell me where to go. Mm-hmm. So you might challenge him, even though he has a firearm. And if they control the media, they can tell you, hey, look, see how violent they are? He's attacking a soldier trying to keep the peace. You know, just it's how you play it all out. And I say, you know, we have to seriously consider how we look at everything.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because me and my wife, we were watching the movie 13 Hours. Have you seen that one?
Yes, sir.
Well, we were watching it, and first of all, it's just crazy because I have to say, if half of what that movie depicts is true, then man, there was some craziness going on. And
right.
I don't really know that you can pin that on one person, but the part that just that gripped us was they would show the families that were right next to the compound, and they were just sitting there as the bombs were going off and the shells were happening. They were just sitting there watching TV as if this was just reality and everything was just normal. And we just couldn't fathom what that would be like to have that amount of craziness going on and you just act as if it's just a normal Saturday night.
That is almost picture perfect copy of what it's like to be a minority sometimes. You know, in America, you just become so accustomed to it, the shock value wears off. It's all about survival. And you're going to get it however you want. You know you can't be like that all the time. So if you're lucky enough to have a way to sustain yourself, a good job, an actual family, maybe a wife and some kids, it helps kind of round you out. You know, bring you back to humanity a little bit, because you don't want to be out there that long, mind-wise, because then you just kind of become this monster and you don't care. But that's my biggest fear, is that the powers that be want to normalize this fear. It's not natural for us to be afraid all the time. It's not natural for us to immediately be on alert when you see somebody that looks different from you. I mean, whatever happened to behavior, you know, just on sight alone, I got to be worried, you know. And I think in a way it kind of kills your discernment. Mm-hmm. I mean, now you don't trust your gut anymore. You just trust your eyes. And sometimes your eyes just don't have enough. They don't have enough data. You know, you look at a guy coming in, you know, it's brown people today. Tomorrow it might be guys with blue eyes or bald guys. You know, it's no
man,
stopping.
I'm screwed then.
I mean, you never know where it's going to go, man, because fear, the whole point of fear is not to necessarily exterminate certain groups of people, but it's designed to keep humanity from this next level. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, but in a way, I see how it also works, because it kind of weans out the fakes. You know, you have certain people who can stand being refined like that. Some will fall off, some will become criminals, some will become monsters. And then you'll have those that just keep going. And we have to be a generation of people that just keep going, and to let the world know and say, well, yeah, we survived all of that to put it behind us. We don't forget it. We definitely don't forget it. We don't forget what it was like to have Nazis everywhere. We don't forget what it was like to be on the brink of just world domination of a mindset, because it wasn't flesh. It wasn't that. It was a mindset. That spirit is just on fire, man. And so, you know, even with all the things that I've endured as, you know, black male here in Oklahoma, America, whatever, I learned it's more about the spirit. So I started pulling away from investing so much of it in this particular race of people doing this, as more as it's the spirit driving us to do it. So that's why the majority of the time, when I'm around somebody who has a different opinion than me, I calmly try to show them a different way. And instead of getting mad and getting pissed off and like, oh, that's crazy. So I know a friend of mine asked me, he said, George, why you got this guy on your page, man? He's a racist. And I said, like, well, no more so than me or you or anybody. It's just where you go with that. Where do you go with that? Now, if you want to have a conversation, I'm your guy. And I'll sit down and talk to you all day long. But if you just want to just have a closed mind, oh, that's it. I don't want to hear it. You know, I had a guy tell me in great detail for hours on end how every black person had either a criminal, an active criminal history, or was about to have one. I said, so what does that say about me? Well, you know, Georgia, you might be in denial, but you're probably well on your way. And I said, and I just started laughing. I said, are you serious, man? I said, okay. I said, you just let me know that I can't talk to you about this. And he's looking at me like, well, statistics say. And I said, well, you have an actual live example standing in front of you, man. I said, you know, that's better than a statistic. You know, I would be an anomaly. Not really. But in your mindset, I would be the first. So let's start with me. Man, he didn't want to start there, man. He just wanted to kind of like make me believe it. And I said, well, I can't. I mean, this is me living. I don't want to beat anybody down or rob nobody. I said, like, man, that's not, it's not a genetic thing. And I told him, I said, you know, we don't even have criminals unless we have criminal conditions. And you got to have that, you know, to get a criminal. You might still have criminals, but it'll be for different reasons. If everybody had an equal share of the money, crimes might all be sexual. I don't know. Right. You know, so crime just, I mean, it's just a component of humanity, man. We just have that flaw. But to assign all the bad, dark, evil deeds to one group of people is crazy. And I can't participate in that. That's why every chance I get, you know, I try to de-escalate or try to educate as much as I can or sit still and shut my mouth and get educated. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times, you know, I'm dead wrong. And people will school me and I'll take it. I'll say, thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, because to me, that's God speaking to me. And I'm going off on this tangent and I feel I'm pretty good. I done pissed all these people off and I feel like I'm just 100% right. And somebody shut me down with peace. And I said, I have to pay attention. This is the Father speaking. So I better learn. Mm-hmm. And take that lesson and add it to myself, you know, and it makes me a better person, I would hope.
So let me ask you, you told that story about you and your mom getting off the bus and that guy making that comment. Was that the first time?
That was the very first time I heard that word.
And that you just realized that life is just going to be
it's different,
a little bit different.
Yes, sir. I mean, you know, I didn't understand. I thought I'd heard that word before, but it was different. I heard Negro. Right. I heard the word Negro because I was watching a television broadcast. And oh, back then, man, I mean, that was the word. Right. And people didn't say black. Negro, Negro, Negro. And I guess whenever they got primed and ready to, you know, drop the authentic N-bomb, my mom would grab me up. Whoop. So I didn't get to hear it, which I'm kind of glad she did it. It didn't damage me too much. I was just, it was more, not even the word. It was just that feeling behind it. Like, what did I do?
Right.
What did we do to him, mama? And she didn't tell me. She just, let's get out of here. And that's when I knew. I said, well, you can not do a thing and be 100% guilty of it. And I didn't like that feeling. You know, I didn't like that at all. Not knowing what I did, because I'd like to know, because I don't want to repeat it.
Right.
But if my crime is being black, I'm stuck. I'm like, that's a death sentence. I said, well, it don't come off. I took plenty of showers and baths, man. It ain't coming off, man. I had this one lady, she actually told me, like, don't touch me. I said, well, ma'am, it won't rub out. Well, I don't know that. Oh, just, yeah. And my response all the time is what it just was just then. I start laughing because I said, that's ridiculous. I said, when has you ever seen anybody just skin color just come off? And that guy's got a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a medical issue. You know, but it's just amazing. It's amazing how superficial that fear and that hatred is. It's superficial. Just it's a thin layer on the top. Mm-hmm. And the conversation would just completely just. But you got to want it.
Right.
You know, you got to be willing to accept something that you might not have heard yesterday. But today was the day you were supposed to listen. You know, I stopped being angry. Well, about a lot of it. Not having the proper respect, that still bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't even imagine what it was like to be, you know, back in, I don't know, 19, 20, and be 70 years old and have some kid call you boy and you had to respond. He said, I'm 70 years old. You know, and I mean, it's just like, and you know that your reaction has to be docile, calm, non-confrontational. You can't show a human reaction of like, what the F did you just say to me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's still here. It's still kind of hanging out. You still can't accuse anybody of anything without getting lined out proper.
That's so interesting. Where the three of us in this podcast, where we grew up, we didn't have a lot of racial tension.
Mm-hmm.
But we also didn't have a lot of racial diversity. I mean, we had maybe 5 black families. Now they were pretty big.
Yeah.
And everyone seemed to like them, but we really didn't have that much diversity. And so it's easy for me to kind of compartmentalize the what you might go through, because I didn't really experience or witness that when I was growing up. But hearing you tell that story, it just breaks my heart to hear that you have to accept that there are people in this world who just don't like you for nothing. And it just kills me. I mean, I'm not going to have to worry about something like this. I mean, if I got off a bus, what are they going to say to me? Oh, look at him, he's bald. Or, oh, look at him, he has too much hair on his face. I mean, at worst, I'm liable to be called a hipster right now. I mean, I guess I could be called a cracker, but I don't even know that anybody even takes offense to something like that. So it just kills me that there is such a large population of people who have to accept that there's just going to be people who don't like them simply for how they look.
Even to the point where, in my coming up, it would be times where people just didn't want to see black people. I don't want them around. And you would get owners of businesses, car dealerships, just ask you to leave. And I mean, once you've understood that this is how it's going to be, you just roll out. Mm-hmm. Just go. You don't think about it. The first time it happens, you pissed or you hurt or you know, you just have this emotional turmoil. You don't know what to do with all of that. But then once you realize, well, they're not going to stop and they don't really care how I feel about it. And you just become immune. You see a lot of black women that just have this hostile exterior. Well, you know, that has a history, too. I don't want to go into that right now because we'll be all night, man. But it kind of you think about the parts of our subculture. I call it a subculture, you know, because it's the culture that had to become because you're not accepted into the main. And like now it's just kind of devolved into this just despicable thing. Right. You see fight videos all on the Internet. Like, what the hell is this? I understand the psychology behind it. The psychology is this. These people are trying to show that they're strong. You probably don't want to mess with me, cross me. You know, so they show everybody how tough they can be or how fast it can escalate. Not realizing or realizing, but not caring that it kind of counts against you. You know, it supports the stereotype now. And people, if you might have had an argument that we're not like that, they just plug in them videos and there you go. Well, what is this? And they don't care or know how it affects somebody who's not doing anything close to that. They just show up in a group. They could just be quiet, you know, and it's just too many. I had this lady, she actually said that. She said, it's just too many of these black kids in here. And I was at a movie theater. He made us leave. And nobody said anything. It was maybe one white patron that kind of turned around and said, like, that's messed up, you know. But everybody else was like, thank you. And just continued looking. Mm-hmm. And the group just leaves. They're still having fun, oblivious to the disrespect, mm-hmm. or just immune at this point now. You know, you either have one or two. You're either just oblivious. And that just becomes, that comes from conditioning from a little kid. You can't go here. And you say, okay. But if you're told that you can go anywhere you want to go, as long as you behave yourself, then you have a different mindset. But that person gets to feel the disrespect and that loss of dignity. You know, even little kids feel loss of dignity. If you tell them, you can't come to my school, you can't come in my classroom with your hair like that. So this is how my hair grows. I don't know how to make it do something different that doesn't make you frightened. Mm-hmm. You say, it's all nappy. Well, it's not nappy. It's curly. Right. Like first thing in the morning, it's nappy. Yeah. Right. Well, once I comb it, it's just curly. It doesn't go away. Right. But you can't you can't get people to see. And I mean, and it's, oh man, it's like that mindset that's cast back onto people who's learned to accept this second, third, fourth, bottom class citizenship. You kind of like, it's a, like a self predatory kind of mindset. You know, you start attacking the blackest guy. It's a group of black guys, but they attack the darkest one. Look at this black whatever, you know. And he's feeling like, come on, man. Yeah. He's got to either take it or, I don't know, man. It's weird. It's like you, either you fall off, you know, I can't handle this, and you just fall off, or you just become the toughest some ever. And it's a lot of tough people out there, man. they used to hearing it. I consider myself pretty tough at this point. Not like I can kick everybody's butt, but just like, can't say a lot that's just going to send me into just, you know, bawling all over the place. And that's not going to happen. I'm just going to laugh, and because I know what you're trying to do, and I'm already past it. But that self-predatory type thing, oh man, I had printed off, I think I left it at the job. We were talking about Willie Lynch. You ever heard of that guy? Lynch. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Well, one day we'll visit on that, man. And it's supposedly he's a British slave owner who came to the States, and he proposed an idea to help slave owners to create a perpetual stock that would not resist or revolt or in any way, you know, fight against this systemic oppressive thing, slavery. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah, yeah, and worked. He likened that process to breaking of a horse, and it's effective. I mean, and he broke it down, and I printed out the original letter that he had sent, and I could get you a copy. But if you read that, and then you look at some of the dynamics playing in the black community, you say, like, there it is, man. The formula is active. It's running. But it was just designed to sustain the slave mind, thinking that slavery was just going to continue. It was profitable. You know, everybody can make a killing. But now you have this new thing coming to where, you know, eventually it resulted in the end of slavery.
You know, David and James are part of this great community, church community down in Hattiesburg called Ecclesia. And on a previous episode, we had their pastor, Mike Dixon, on as our guest. And he had been reading this book. I can't remember what it was called. It was something about things white people love or something like that. And one of the chapters was about how white people love awareness. Constantly wearing Live Strong bracelets, or we have shirts that says I heart boobies or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And so he was going on about how white people love awareness, but when it comes to actually having skin in the game, we fall short a lot. And recently I had been doing some reading up on different things, and I came across have you ever heard of Brian Stevenson?
I don't recall him right now, but I'm going to look for him when I get
home. He is he's a lawyer in Alabama, and he runs an organization called the Equal Justice Initiative, EJI.org, I believe is their website. And what he does is he defends death row inmates and people who have been thrown so far into the system that nobody's willing to defend them. And their website has different resources about what was actually going on for African Americans, the lynchings that led up to the 50s and different things like that. And it's a really great website, but with that, being that white people, one of the things that we can do is we can fight the crazy views of other white people, but what are some ways that we can actually be effective?
Well, the awareness is a good thing. That awareness as long as it's a genuine awareness, that's a good thing. That's a good start. The second part, I think, is finding the courage to go into the action. And the action is pretty much like I called it out at the beginning. Just call it out. Say exactly what it is. Hey, it's a bad deal. We know it's a bad deal. It's time to stop pretending like, you know, you guys just not trying hard enough. If you have systems in, you know, if you have systems in place designed for one group to succeed in another group, well, you know, sink or swim, you have to be realistic about calling that out. And that's the second part, I think. Just you're aware of it, call it out. And then you have to, I don't think it's much more. It has to be like it's a partnership. I think it's a partnership. Not only do you have to be aware of it, call it out, but look for other people who are wanting a dialogue about it. You know, and I can understand the fear or you know, you don't want to get shunned. Because I know I talked to a couple of my friends who are white. They say, well, you know, I didn't want to be branded as a race traitor. And I said, like, you can't betray the human race by speaking out on things that go against the human race.
I got to be honest, I don't even really know what that means. Like, I'm assuming that white people not liking him because he's speaking out.
Right. To try to speaking out against, you know.
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
But to get over the fear, you can't lose anything. You can't lose anything. To be humane, I think, is probably one of the highest forms of our humanity, I'm thinking. To you know, to be privileged. How honorable is that? To maintain this state of privilege if you have to be the type of human being that could look at the situation of your brothers and be okay with it. And you know, and to flip it and say it's because they didn't try hard enough or they didn't do this and they didn't do that. Well, you have to bring an awareness. With the awareness, that means you are aware and called out that we have systems that stop them from that has historically stopped them from moving forward. It's not like just yesterday. You know, a lot of people, especially when you get into conversations with people who are fresh into this conversation about race and still have the old traditional mindsets, they say, well, you know, well, Black's been lazy since slavery ended. And I'm like, are you sure? I mean, because you have to tell me about your experiences as a Black person in order for me to value that what you just said. And because it's not just that simple. I mean, one of the first things that people try to do once it became possible for them to vote is they tried to vote and to get denied or threatened by pain of death. I mean, you're like, well, hell, I ain't going today. You know, you don't want to be that guy swinging from the tree. You're just trying to exercise your right. At some point you're saying like, all right, good. This is my opportunity. I'm going to be an American now. I'm going to vote. And I'm listening to what this guy says. I want to vote for him. I don't like what that guy says because he's talking about cutting me off. That process got cut out for you. You just completely denied that. So we have to agree that, man, that was just bad business. We set it off on people and it just happened. We can't pretend like the situation with the Native Americans is just a result of them just being weak. Or militarily, they weren't superior. Well, okay. But did that make everything that happened right? You know, you got to think about it. So are you trying to be a righteous person? Or are you just trying to maintain this false sense of privilege? Because it's a false sense. You think about it. If you create more enemies and you don't have an effective way to fight them, they will overwhelm you at some point. And I think that's what causes people to have this fear to where they don't even want to start. They don't even want to start because they think, oh, I don't want to be on the front lines of this conversation. If I get out there and now start talking about race, they might get pissed off and beat me up. And I was like, no, it's not going to happen. Not if you come at it like a person. If you come at it like, you know, an asshole, it'll probably happen, you know. But you have to, as far as what white people can do to make it better, I think it's just tell the truth about it. Put yourself in that person's shoes. You can't listen. You can't have the Fox filter going through your ears because Fox will tell you all kinds of stuff. Amazing stuff about Black people. This one guy told me all Black people get this free, that free, free cars, free housing, free food. I'm like, holy crap. where's that line? I promise I'm getting in it tomorrow. Right. You know, but the awareness, I know it seems like a weak start, but man, that's where it happens. That's where it happens. Right. You know,
I'm not trying to talk that down.
No. It's just like, because I understood what you were saying. I understand it. It's just like, that's kind of like, that's all I have to do is be aware about it. Be aware, you know, but at some point, this is going to come in on me. I mean, I can only isolate myself so much. Either I accept this inclusion, and I mean, you still got to go through the process, man. Are you a good person? That's never left the table. If you're stopping at color or if you're stopping at religion, man, you're doing yourself an injustice. You're guaranteeing that you're going to have more battles than you're willing to fight. And the minute we all get it, and I think we're getting it, I really do. I think we're getting it. As far as President Trump, bless his heart, I don't even think he's getting anything. Something's wrong with the guy. It's beyond racist and all. It's something else is going on with that guy. But the people that were attracted to him, to his style and his format, I think the people that were attracted to that are starting to see the error because they see how it can go bad for them. And that's what it is. And I said, it's not enough to just be aware and just, it's their fault. Once you start picking up some proximity, like it's starting to come to me now, it's getting closer to affecting me. So now you kind of like starting to see what your neighbor sees. You're starting to see what your brother sees, and it starts that process of changing. Like you said, that's the awareness part. Once the awareness kicks in, so well, how do I stop it? And I said, I don't know. How do you stop it? Because this is pretty much your beast. I mean, because you're talking to people who had to survive on the back end. If you don't allow me to have matches, you can't turn around and ask me how I've been making fire. That's my business. Right. No, but, you know, I mean, but people are more than willing to share the stories and share the experience as long as they feel like they're talking to a genuine person. So I would say, you know, going out, if you're armed with this desire to make a change or do something positive, be honest. And so I really don't want to have that conversation. Don't have that conversation. I don't want to go over there and talk to that black guy over there. Don't talk to him. Talk to that guy. Follow your gut. And eventually you'll get enough pieces of this puzzle and you'll say, like, okay, I see it now. And you'll know how to proceed from there. Or whatever influence that you may have, you can probably expand it. Who knows how far it can go. But you have to be honest. You have to be passionate. I think you have to be passionate about, I love this, what you're doing here. I mean, that's awesome. You are the very first person in my entire life that has ever asked me to do something like this.
Oh, really?
So, oh, yes, sir. And I'm 52. And I'm just like, I'm all, I don't know. I felt great, man. Because I love to run my mouth, as you can tell. But that's all it is, man. We need more genuine people. Genuine people who really want to see, who don't want to be afraid. I don't want to be afraid anymore. That's one of the biggest things you can do. So I don't want to be scared anymore. I don't want to turn on the TV and see, because I look at TV sometimes, so I wouldn't go over there. The dude is huge. He got them big old lips. I don't know. He's scary, you know. And then he's mad. Oh, hell no. I ain't going over there.
I don't want to go over there just for the simple fact that he's mad.
You would be amazed at how much conversation you would get out of that same guy if you come off as a genuine person. Mm-hmm. Don't pretend like you can fix everything for him. So, like, man, I just want to talk, man. What's it like? You might get some anger, you know, but you can't be afraid, right. You know, and people have a tendency, even the most hostile person, they have a tendency to know when I hate to just make everything so spiritual because that's just me. But you have a tendency to resonate with that God aspect in a person and it calms you down. You say, well, OK, I can talk to this guy. Like, Brad, you got that all over you, man. I mean, you just got this God aura. And it's like, When you come around, you immediately feel like, I like this guy. I don't know why I like him so much, but I like him. Mm-hmm. And then after talking to him, oh, yeah, man, he's my guy. That's my guy right there. I'll never worry about him. You know, it's just that aura. But it's who you are as a person on the inside. And you have to be cool with this thing that I want to do. I'm honest with it. I'm fully invested in doing it. I'm not trying to get like an award or nothing like that. I just want an understanding. And that genuine thing coming off, man, people just ready to talk to you. Mm-hmm. They're ready.
Man, I gotta tell you, I love that you just mentioned the courage that it's gonna take. Because a while back, I was listening to another podcast, and the people on there were talking about race relations and gender equality and other similar topics. And one of the guests on the episode mentioned that it isn't going to be the people who are being affected that are going to necessarily make the biggest impact. It's going to be the little conversations and the education that flows organically from those conversations. For instance, if you go stand on a corner and preach about the hardships that your community is going through, you might get a label.
Right.
But if we used a little courage,
yes, sir,
and we go over to our peers and say something like, hey, that joke isn't okay, or hey, maybe you shouldn't treat this person right, the way that you are, and then you would have the opportunity to educate about things like the GI Bill or mass incarceration, and you try to educate little by little. Then maybe it wouldn't be when somebody is 31 that they learn about this stuff as I did. But maybe they would learn at 21 and be able to affect change much earlier. I mean, I gotta tell you, at 21, I couldn't have told you any of those things. But I'd like to think that if I did, I'd like to think that I would have stood up and I'd have tried to educate and try to bring people together. As we start to bring this conversation down to a close and we start to land this plane, is there anything you would like to say to kind of summarize what all we've talked about? And kind of what would you say to the younger generations who are coming up and maybe just now starting to learn about prejudices and false thoughts that people have towards other races? How would you address those people, and how would you summarize what we've talked about?
Well, I would say, I think that for the most part, the hardest work has already been done. We just have to realize that things like this, I mean, having this conversation, this dialogue, are all the things that are necessary to fill in the blanks of the history that's been kept from us. I think going forward, we as a country or a world people need to continuously ask why. You have to be brave enough to challenge your own beliefs. You might have been holding on to this same belief for 20, 30, 40 years, and all of a sudden, so much information to the contrary is just hitting you, and it's overwhelming. It's like, am I wrong? You know, be brave enough to see. Go see. Are you wrong? And I think the only thing that we really can do at this point is to continuously ask ourselves why. You know, why is this? And as long as we do that, we kind of keep ourselves from becoming stagnant in the spirit. Once you become stagnant in the spirit, it's easier to just listen to the stereotypes. I'm done engaging with people. I'll just listen to the stereotypes. I'll let that carry me through the rest of my days. I'm doing pretty good. I don't have a reason to interact with this, you know, so I won't. And I think that's part of one of the biggest parts of our problem now. It's not so much as access to things as engagement. We don't engage because we don't have to. I don't have to know anything about the refugees. I'm not a refugee. I don't live in a state that keeps them. So why do I care? And that's where the disconnect in the humanity part of it happens. We have to constantly keep ourselves into this why. When you start making people feel ashamed, like we used to in the old days, if you did something that was shameful, everybody let you know. Your mom, your dad, your aunts, your friends. Man, that was terrible. Why'd you do that? And you would have some kind of remorse. You're like, oh, I guess I shouldn't. They're not saying that like everybody should just hammer on you, but we don't have shame anymore. We make everything okay. Stop trying to make everything fit in one mold. The guy who's trying to vouch for peace, he's not weak. He's like the strongest, you know, because I told one of my friends who's former military, I said, just because we become trained to kill, does that mean we should go around doing it all the time? Does that mean we were right in doing it in the first place? Because we had a different mindset when we went into the military. once you get deployed, you're on this campaign and it's going on for months. You know, the first week you might feel like John Wayne. I wish somebody would, you know. Then after about, 6 or 7 months of the same old, same old, same, you get tired of smelling burnt flesh. You're tired of running up on bodies. And then you start saying, hey, man, I don't think this is what our creator wants us to be doing. Does it make you a weaker man? I don't think so. I think it makes you a man of some depth. I'm not just a killer. Every man is capable of killing. People overrate. Yeah, it's overrated. Yeah. So you can snap a guy's neck and
right.
What if he anticipates this is getting ready to happen and puts a bullet in your forehead? Is he tougher now? Like, no, he just got the drop on you. So that's not, we need to elevate the higher aspects of our existence instead of glorifying the lower parts. Like everybody me and my ex, man, we would go round and round about this. And I told, right when I started hearing this little saying like, don't let me forget it. Oh, what is it? It was about the forgiveness thing. I can't even think what the quote was now. Anyway, I was trying to tell her, I said, this is how we empower the weaker people. And the weaker people being the ones who glorify the hostility. They glorify the violence. That's always the mode. Everything is violent because they know they're a part of this spirit that has a time limit. It's a temporal spirit. It, as long as time exists, it has power, right? So if you start moving towards the things that are more eternal, like peace, love, fearful, it becomes fearful. So it invokes fear. It's like it just stokes it, like get everybody pissed off. And next thing you know, man, we got everybody pissed. Mm-hmm. And hiding behind all of this fear, he's like, oh, yes, sir. I bought myself 2 more days, or I bought myself another millennia. But because it knows that as long as if peace and understanding and knowledge and wisdom is allowed to manifest naturally, its days are over. Mm-hmm. So now we have this new human, you know, on the horizon, this person who's insightful. And, you know, instead of thinking about war, we get serious about what we're doing at work, you know, cleaning water, you know, and providing clean resources and, you know, and energy for countries that don't have it or never had it. Now, that's noble, man. That's something we're supposed to do. You know, surely somebody's going to say, oh, make a buck. But the reality of it is, I mean, it's a noble thing and we should pursue it 100%. And that's, I think that's the true human nature, because we all feel the same way when we see certain things. A lot of us, and I mean a lot of us, I would say a huge percent of us, always get this warm, fuzzy feeling when we see a puppy, you know, or when you see a little baby just learning to walk. And it doesn't matter if the baby is from India or Africa. Oh, look at the little baby, you know. In that moment, you catch yourself. This is my true self. My true self is to praise the life. And all of these lower aspects, these different layers underneath, we keep glorifying it. That's why racism is still here. We got all of these awesome inventions now. We got this. It just amazes me. Like they have this. I was looking at this article on the internet. The stuff Vesta Black. Have you ever heard of it? Mm-hmm. It absorbs 99.9% of light.
Oh wow!
You could shine a flashlight directly on it. You can't see anything, right? This stuff is like awesome. And I said, we invent stuff like this. And it was another, it's a new alloy we just recently created. We're coming up with all of these innovative things to let me know. And then you see all of these little stories of kids coming out with IQs of like 160. It was like, it was unreal. Not just one kid, but like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 in all different parts of the world. And I say, you know what this is? This is the emergence of this human that this enemy is fighting desperately. That's why I feel like it's starting to build to a frenzy so much. That's why I know it's on horizon. So we have to be vigilant. Going back to what we was talking about before, what we can do is just stay on course, and continue doing the good thing. Know when to walk away, because some people just designed for that. You know, some people are designed for hate and destruction, and they'll do their job. They'll die doing their job. They want to do it. And it would be wrong of us to just try to turn them. If they so, I mean, because the last thing in the world I want to do is take away somebody's belief. I don't want to take away your belief. But if that spirit that I feel off of you is saying, like, I want to talk about it, George, I'm going to talk. And then we can hammer out something else. But if you let me know, I'm not going to go to a Klan rally and try to talk to them about equality. Unless they come up to me and it's like, what in the world made you think you could? And I'll tell them. But the ones coming at me with a rope and a gun, I said, oh, roll out. I don't want no trouble. But it's just having the courage to get past yourself, to say, hey, man, you know, this is what I want to do. I feel it. It's calling me. So I might as well listen, because that's not just you. That's this thing that keeps all of us, you know, together in this unity thing. It's not a hippie dream, you know, like it's not drug induced, man. This is our true persona. You know, our true persona, man, is to be eternal. And eternity is love and understanding and wisdom. And everything else, the temporal things, the things that are passing are things. I don't want to sound like a pastor right now, but it's the lust. I mean, things like appetites. You can never feel an appetite. You don't believe me? At lunchtime, you eat, you're hungry again. I mean, it's no fulfilling that. You can't fill up your ears full of hearing, like the Bible says, you know. So these temporal things that are just time-based, they'll always have this appetite. But with the things that are eternal, they're outside of time. So they have patience involved in it. It's all, that's why it says no fear in love, right? Because fear is time-based and everything else is godly. So having that, I think the reason why we get so much pushback and so much resistance, because this one person over here is fully vested in this other spirit, and this person over here is evolving into this other one, and they don't go together. Mm-hmm. It's like natural opposites. So they hate you. They try to convince you that what you're doing is stupid, or you a traitor. And I've been called a traitor. I've been called a traitor because they're talking about, you know, the black man gonna rise and do this. I say, yeah, why would you resuscitate this beast? Mm-hmm. I said, supremacy does not work. Have you not seen that? I mean, it's like, so, you know, I got people, some people in my family, man, they don't talk to me no more. Because I just don't, and they know I don't. I said, I don't do that. There's no supreme race unless you talk about the human race. And we're far from supreme right now because we're so divided. And we're divided for the wrong reasons. There's very little difference on the outside, but there's a ton of difference on the inside. If we could meet each person spirit first, we would know right away who our brother is and who our sisters are. We would know right away. Hey, it's this feeling. It's like when I saw you, Brad, I never met you before. And I said, that's my brother right there. I feel it. I feel at home. I feel at home with this guy. I feel completely relaxed. I don't feel nervous. Because you see, now I'm just running my mouth. So with people I don't feel comfortable around, I kind of keep it short, mm-hmm. you know, because I know they're aggravated with my presence.
Right.
Because I'm going to try at some point to say, hey, that's not fair. George, join us. No, I don't think so. I don't like that side. Mm-hmm. As I get older, I realize that race is less and less an issue. I have to remember sometimes that I'm a black person. Mm-hmm. I do. And it's not that I don't have any respect for the things that I've been through. It's just that, man, I feel myself growing past it. So, and I think in part, that's probably some of the reason why I'm able to get in conversations with people that are so different from me. Like they might have overtly racist views. And by the end of the day, we're having 3-hour discussions. Mm-hmm. And they, you want a beer? And not realizing this dude is playing.
Right.
You know, somebody else coming, oh, George is cool. It's not George. That's not George who you're talking to. This is something different. And so the more I realize that's exactly what it is, I lose my sense of being a black person until somebody reminds me, you know, limitation, 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 limitation. So, okay, I get you. Right. I had to remember how to play within the confines and work my way back up to godly. You know? But it's a great ride, man. I wouldn't have it any other way. I really wouldn't, man. I truly enjoy being here and being part of this. I enjoy it, man. It gives me a chance to get some of this stuff out of my attic here in my brain.
You know, one of the positives that I have seen come out of all of the political craziness that is going on right now is that you're starting to see people understand the importance of community.
Yes, sir.
And when I say community, I don't just mean community of people who think the same way or act the same way or look the same way. I'm talking about, and to use another spiritual term here, I'm talking about people are understanding what it is to join each other at the table. And really what I mean by that is, you know, you and I may not see eye to eye when it comes to politics. We may be on the opposite ends of the spectrum with that. We may not even think the same when it comes to life decisions, how to manage money, whatever it might be. But if we can all learn that we're all the same in God's eyes, and if we can learn how to join each other at the table, then I think this world could be a better place.
You know what? I take that and I expand that. I have expanded that idea out bigger. I wouldn't say that I'm a Christian, but that was a lot of my upbringing, and I understood it, and I see how it plays into this. It's like a universal understanding more than a singular boxed package God piece. Sometimes I think that this is a gigantic, I don't know, just me, I'm getting ready to get weird. But I think this is a gigantic experience for one being, just one, because this being is being asked this question: would you choose life or knowledge of good and evil? And being a creature of free will and independent thought, I said, well, what's the route where I would learn good and evil? So I think having that choice, and that choice was made, I guess, symbolically. Is that a word? I don't know. In the Bible. But I think in a real sense, this is like all of us are Adam going through this span of existence to where he's completely separated. And to have knowledge of good and evil, you have to know what it's like to be divided like manifold times. First, male and female, then good and evil, then these different, I don't know, we didn't have race then. That's kind of new, but to have all these, to be surrounded by all of this difference, and now I don't see the sameness. So it's kind of like being insane in a way. And that's how this other spirit is allowed to or able to influence us so much, because we're in a state of shock. We're so divided. And it almost kind of makes me think of a person with multiple personalities. Which one is me? Which one is really me? I mean, am I this guy? Am I this guy? Am I this guy? And you have all of these, and all of them are 100% real, and they have experiences, right? And how do I get it all together again? Now it's too much. It's too much data. I'm too divided. I'm too separated. We have wars. We have all of these different points of views. You know, you got 12 apostles walking with, you know, the word in the flesh, and everybody comes back with a different version. You know, it's like, man, we're still so divided, because as long as we occupy this crazy place, this state of time, as long as we're in this dominion of time, we'll never have it all together. So it's those rare moments where we get it, we totally get it, and we should keep moving on it. You know, once we understand it, like, hey, you know, maybe that guy ain't so different from me. You know, I think we're surrounded by all of this different because our creator wanted us to realize, even with all this difference, you are the same. I tried to explain this to a friend of mine who's a pastor, and he was hammering at me. And he was saying, well, you know, just some people is just, it's supposed to be divided. You know, some people this. And I said, well, I see it as the body. I see it as a body. You have hands, you have arms, you have legs, you have eyes, you have ears, all of this difference, but they all reside in the same house. It's the same house. So let's say the eyes thought one day that they were better than everybody else because they were up high. We're closer to the brain. Screw you guys. Can they leave the body and be self-sufficient? Maybe. But they don't do nothing all day but look. They don't even know what they're looking at because they're separated from the brain now. They're just looking. You know, so without all of these different aspects and these different parts coming together to remember that oneness, and we're just broken bodies, man. And, you know, I used that on him, and he kind of like had a moment, cocked his head to the side, and just hammered that way at me again, told me to read these scriptures. And I said, all right, I got you. You know, but I think we sometimes get off on this tangent. To like, I got this concept that there should be some kind of unity, but just this unity. Like, maybe it's just in that little analogy I tried to throw out there. Maybe in this scenario, it's just the hand, and the hand realizes, hey, I need all my fingers. You know, I got all five fingers now, and this is the body. Because they don't remember how to attach everything. And so this is the body. And this, we're right, and everything else is wrong. And that's where we're at. But I think once we get it, we're supposed to have this interaction. We're supposed to have this conversation. And now it's time to come back together again. You guys been out there long enough. Okay, that's enough knowledge of good and evil. Bring it in. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening. And it's happening at a rate that we probably can't even understand. They're entertaining the idea of going to different planets. I don't think we'll be successful until we figure out how to work with this one. It's not one of those things like where, you know, you go to this awesome Garden of Eden, maybe, and leave all your trash and not be responsible for picking it up. You just bounce out, get in the car and just roll out to the next spot. Say, oh, no, sir, you got to go clean that up. So I don't think we'll ever be able to have that free run of the universe and all of this good stuff until we figure out what it is we're doing wrong here. You cannot maintain this supremacist mindset and stay healthy in your spirit. You can't stay healthy in your body. Definitely not in this interactive environment that we have. I mean, people will tear you apart. So you have to. Why am I surrounded by all of this that I hate so much and I loathe so much? You think about it. If you bought into the concept that you have a creator, a God who loves you and loves just you, why would he do you like this to be surrounded by all of this bad and evil? So like, you think that's your God? Is that how God gets down? Mm-hmm. So you got to think, well, why? It goes back to that. You ask why? Because he said, you ask and you'll receive.
Right.
So if I want the knowledge, then you'll get the knowledge. If I want the wisdom, I'll get the wisdom. And once I get the wisdom, I'm almost there, man. Mm-hmm. You know, so then I can leave this and not be so distraught, you know.
Right.
Oh, I didn't do this in my life. I didn't do that in my life. I said those were just peripheral tasks. The main agenda was to understand what it is about this oneness that you keep missing. And then you can come back home. I think that's the reason why they, you know, they say, well, you know, such passed on. So how come they don't ever come back and visit? You know, mm-hmm. Why would they? I mean, if I got on the outside and saw how crazy it was, I said, oh, I can't believe I was in there that long. And it's just probably not even seconds or whatever. I mean, it's just time itself is just crazy.
It is so crazy that you just used that analogy about one body, because literally driving to work today, I was listening to a podcast and it was about that exact thing.
Yes, sir.
It was a podcast by a guy named Rob Bell, who used to be a pastor, and he got to talking about the Eucharist,
mm-hmm.
and how the way the Eucharist was originally set up and what it was designed to do originally was to remind everybody that we are one body. We are in this together. But somewhere along the way, we have turned it into my individual experience with Jesus.
Yes, sir.
That was never what it was intended to do. The original symbolism was to remind us that we are one body,
right.
All in need of Jesus.
All of us. Yes, sir. I think we have a compulsion, or not compulsion, that's kind of strong. I think we have this it's a calling. I know it is to return back to this oneness. So I think that is so corrupted. Corrupted from being here, that we turn it into other things. We deify everything. Everything that's beautiful, we deify it. The woman is the only thing, you know, worth saving, you know. Then we glorify the woman and we deify the woman. And then she is a human, you know, in the same situation that we're in. And she can't help you. And I think that's part of our problem. We had this original understanding with the Lord and who he is and what he set out to do, coming to bring us this word. And we just got caught up in the zeal, because I think once we partially get it, we think we got it. And then we just run with it. Oh, getting ready to create a religion. Mm-hmm. Off of this right here, what I know. And I'm going to tell everybody about it. Next thing you know, we're drinking Kool-Aid. 800 gone. You know, Guyana tragedy, whatever. But so we have to be careful. When we get this call, it's a call, but it's a continuous call. Don't stop there. Keep going. Because he told all the disciples, you know, you guys are going to, you're going to deviate. You're going to stray off the path. Oh, no. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You're going to do it. I've seen it. I saw you do it. Yeah. And it's going to happen. I'm not saying that you guys can't pull it off, but your flesh right now. Mm-hmm. And that's just the nature of flesh. Mm-hmm. You don't beat yourself up. But as long as we do things like this, recognize that, hey, man, you know, it's something we need to talk about. We need to start a dialogue about something, anything that gets us on common ground, and to realize, you know, this person over here is just as human as I am, and take off that shell. That shell is just irrelevant. I mean, this is what this person looks like every day. We'd probably scare crap out of each other if we were just in our true forms. It's too much light. When we're surrounded by darkness, darkness is afraid. So, you know, we have to be afraid of what we see. So it's nuts, man. It's so nuts. The moment I realized that this can't be right, going back to, you know, when I'm viewing life as a black person, I said, this can't be right. I mean, there's something wrong with this. Mm-hmm. So how can it be okay to whip a person on their back until you can see their spinal column and think that they're supposed to just love you? That's not happening. Mm-hmm. Yes, they want to see you dead because you keep hurting them. I bet if you stopped whipping them and asked them nicely, you know, they wouldn't go do that. Slavery probably would have had a different kind of feel to it. And so, you know, we had this period in our history that was dark. You know, we didn't really understand. We thought we could enslave people, but that ain't ever been the conversation. Mm-hmm. The conversation is all, you know, they just, you know, we stopped doing it because they were whining and complaining, whatever the case may be. But, you know, we always have to justify what we did because we can't deal with it. Mm-hmm. Can't deal with the enormity of the offense. Just admit to it.
Right.
Walk up to it and say, like, I can't do this. Right. And don't give it any more power.
Well, you know, there's an analogy that's been running through my head since I heard you make this comment. You made a comment earlier about how we as people tend to lump everybody together. You know, we see on the news all the shootings in, say, Chicago, and somehow we tend to think that stuff like that is going on here, or just seems to happen everywhere. But it made me think of this analogy, and I don't know if it's a good analogy or not, but it made me kind of think of the pit bull breed for dogs. There's a lot of people who are afraid of pit bulls. A lot of people who, if they see them walking down the street, get a little nervous, probably just expecting them to be hyper aggressive and come and chew their throat out or something. But the reality of those dogs is that they're actually very, very sweet dogs. They're very loyal. They're very kind. They're great to have with young kids because of that. But people don't see that. People see you know, the story about the pit bull who got out and attacked another dog or something. And the reality is, like, that aggression is taught. It's not, or was bred into them by humans. It's not their natural tendency. And the same can be said for humans. I mean, you look at Ferguson, and those people had a legitimate argument there. Some bad stuff happened in that town. And instead of maybe hearing that classic denial that you hear around of, well, my family didn't own slaves, maybe we could just acknowledge, like, slavery happened. It was awful. Maybe we could just say, hey, man, I'm sorry. And even if they blow you off and tell you to get out of their face or something of that nature, maybe you planted a seed, because maybe next time when somebody finally acknowledges, hey, slavery was awful and I'm sorry, maybe that seed you planted will soften their heart to the point where they're able to say, thank you. And then maybe they can progress in their relationship. I mean, I'm certainly no expert, but I know having conversations with somebody like George, who's willing to be open and honest with me and allow me to be open and honest with him, and we can have a legitimate conversation, I feel like that's a step forward.